the collective wisdom of the group can be helpful to you as you go ahead and approach things at your site. So I'm going to give a quick update on the trial, again recognizing that there are both new sites as well as existing sites here, and also where we stand with moving forward with the study. Just the disclosures again, we're very grateful for the support from the National Institutes of Health and the NHLBI. The study is conducted under an IDE, as you see here, from the FDA. It's registered appropriately in clinicaltrials.gov, and we do, or I receive research support from Cook Medical, and the study receives research support from MediUSA, the donation of compression stockings. Again, thank you very much to the Medi folks for doing that. So again, post-thrombotic syndrome is a common ailment in people who have had a proximal DVT. Perhaps 20% of people with a proximal DVT ultimately develop a moderate or severe form of post-thrombotic syndrome. And studies have shown that this exerts a significant impact upon their daily life and their health-related quality of life. Again, the most typical symptoms are chronic leg aching and swelling and pain. A minority of patients develop skin changes, and then an even smaller minority ultimately develop ulcers like the one that you see depicted here. Obviously, in the population that we're looking at for the CTRAC trial, the skin changes and the ulcer are more frequent than they are in populations that have lesser degrees of disability. It would be ideal to be able to prevent the post-thrombotic syndrome, and an awful lot of work has been done in multiple clinical trials to try to do that. Unfortunately, to date, most cases of post-thrombotic syndrome can't really be prevented by anything that we know of. Anticoagulation helps to prevent recurrences. That probably helps. But beyond that, there really aren't clear-cut ways to prevent the occurrence of the post-thrombotic syndrome. For many years, this idea of the open vein hypothesis has been out there. And basically, we've learned over the years that venous pressures in the leg, what we call ambulatory venous hypertension, so venous pressures when you're standing and walking, correlate with the skin manifestations of post-thrombotic syndrome. And venous pressures are elevated by both obstruction of the deep veins and also by valvular reflux in the deep veins. In the COVEN trial, which was a randomized trial evaluating catheter-directed thrombolysis, the 6-month and 24-month venous patency, whether or not the veins were open, did correlate with whether or not a patient got the post-thrombotic syndrome. In the ATTRACT trial, whether or not the common femoral vein was open at 1 month also predicted late clinical outcomes. And so there's a reasonable question to ask, which is, does elimination of venous obstruction, once it's already there in someone with post-thrombotic syndrome, help patients in the long run and reduce the severity of their post-thrombotic syndrome? Now, there have been many preliminary studies. You know, the first stents I probably put in the iliac vein were in the 1990s, actually. So this, you know, this therapy has gone back more than 20 years at this point. Most of the studies, almost all of them, have really been retrospectively performed and reported. And so there isn't really high-quality prospective data on the use of stents. But bottom line is that, you know, some of these studies were summarized by Mahmoud Razavi in sort of a pooled analysis a few years ago. And they suggest that about 2/3 of patients who are treated with iliac vein stenting exhibit some degree of improvement in pain, swelling, and healing of their venous ulcers. Again, there's no control group in the vast majority of these studies. But these findings have also been seen in the more recently done prospective single-arm studies of the new stents as well. Approximately the same results or similar results have been seen, possibly slightly better, but that remains to be seen. Now, on the other hand, while we have made some positive observations early on after people get stented, there are a number of very important questions that we have to ask as well. First of all, we know that in select centers, the people that report on these things report very good results. Can most providers, when you take this out to a larger number of providers, can you reliably open chronically occluded veins? It's not always easy to do, right? Can you do it frequently enough and get enough of a bang for the buck to make it worth the downsides? Will the stents stay open? Right now, the primary patency of legacy stents that have been on the market for many years, in people who have post-thrombotic syndrome, have been maybe in the 60-80% range at 1 year. Well, if you think about it, many of these people are young. And you know, when you say 60-80% at 1 year, what are you really saying about the long run here, right? And then what's the long-term risk benefit? In other words, to what extent are the benefits maintained over time? We don't really necessarily have the answer to that question. And are there any new long-term risks that may pop up in addition to the issue of stent stenosis and occlusion? We know that CMS has been looking at this very carefully. In 2016, they had a MedCAC meeting, which basically is an advisory meeting kind of to look at payment and appropriateness of evidence in particular areas. They looked very carefully at chronic venous disease and concluded, and some of us were at that meeting, and they were pretty blunt about the fact that the only thing they cared about were randomized trials. I mean, lots of very eminent people spoke very strongly in favor of endovascular therapy at that meeting, and they just got blank looks from the panel, basically asking, but those aren't randomized studies. And to some extent, that's probably a valid consideration. We know that value-based care is important, and these are costly procedures as well, so showing a benefit is very important. We're entering a world of personalized medicine, and the question I think many of us have had is, well, we're putting a lot of stents in, are we over-treating people, right? Are we treating people with milder disease? Are we treating people with milder lesions? Are we treating people who just aren't likely to ultimately have that long-term benefit because of poor inflow or other reasons? We know that when complications occur with permanently implanted devices, the long-term perceptions about it can be magnified by social media. They can be magnified for in other ways. We've seen what have happened with IVC filters. And so again, these are all wonderful reasons to do a good study that really characterizes the risk-benefit accurately. Just to give some of you some background, in 2014, the NHLBI funded a planning grant once we disclosed our intent to try and do a study like this. So for 2 years, we were able to kind of bring together the different parts of the medical community to plan the study. And again, the idea was we really want broad input into a study like this. Many different types of physicians see people with post-thrombotic syndrome and have different perceptions and experiences around the condition. Some of us that do procedures, we see a subset of patients probably at the most severe end, but other physicians see other types of patients, and it's very important to get people together. We also brought in methodological experts and regulatory experts to talk about planning this kind of trial. We had an expert panel meeting in Chicago that defined much of the structure of this clinical trial. We ultimately developed a protocol, got community endorsements, and started our first year, our one-year planning phase or active startup phase of the trial in 2017, and finally we were funded for the full trial in 2018 and enrolled the first patient then as well. Most of our sites have been active for somewhere between 12 and 18 months. And so we now have some initial information on the doing of the study in the real world and the challenges that one might encounter. In our planning process, we thought very carefully about which treatments for post-thrombotic syndrome should be allowed in the study, what should be required, what should be optional and up to kind of local provider preference, and what should be not allowed. There was a lot of discussion around that with experts from different fields. We talked about strategies to enhance adherence. We know that this particular population is severely affected. We know that in an endovascularly focused network, many of the physicians are really used to moving to endovascular therapy relatively early, and that therefore maintaining people in a control arm for long periods of time, whether or not it would be feasible and for how long, there was a lot of uncertainty about that, and that's why we designed the study the way we did, with a 2-year follow-up period, but with the primary outcome assessed at 6 months. One very important part of this is that we anticipate that patients in both treatment arms are going to be actively managed. And that's really important at the clinical centers. I mean, some people have had their PTS for 10 years. They feel they've already tried many things for their PTS. And if they get randomized to the control arm, their enthusiasm to continue in the study is going to be dependent on their feeling that there's an active attention to their problem. And so people in both arms are being seen by clinical teams at 2 months and at 4 months, right? And the idea being that at that point, the compression therapies are reviewed, medical therapies are reviewed, and ulcer care is reviewed. The idea being you can tune things up, make changes, and try and improve their symptoms so that they're seeing a real benefit from being in the study. In the study, we're leveraging our experience with the ATTRACT trial, which is another large randomized trial that we completed a few years ago. But there are definitely similarities and differences. In particular, the differences are that ATTRACT was acute DVT patients that are often in the hospital and kind of in front of you. With CTRACT, so many of the patients we seek are nowhere to be seen. They're not in front of us. a minority may come into our clinics, but most of them are just out in the world, and it's on us, it's incumbent on us to go and find them out there. And so for that reason, some of our strategies have been aimed at working with external community partners, creating external awareness. We have a mobile app to try and help you connect up referrers with clinical centers, and we need to continue to improve upon that. We have a long way to go, really. We always recognize that investigator equipoise would be a challenge in this kind of study. I think there's national equipoise around these questions, but then again, when you talk about an individual provider in an individual center, if one has been practicing in a particular way for a long time, one usually believes in what one has been doing. And so in the course of planning the trial, we actually queried specific scenarios to a group of about 35 physicians that were kind of from different subspecialty backgrounds, and asked them about their level of comfort with continuing to manage a patient in a particular way, for example, without going to endovascular therapy, with different levels of disease severity over different levels, different amounts of time. The idea being to really understand what are we likely to see when we try and do this study and maintain people in their assigned treatment arms over time, and that really informed the design of the trial. We'll be talking a lot about equipoise today and how to really convey that and communicate that to patients. I want to, you know, for me as a physician and scientist, it's been a true blessing to be able to work with what I view as really a dream team of investigators. This study has been designed and planned by a very diverse group of people with incredibly disparate types of expertise, methodological expertise, economic expertise, clinical expertise in different domains. And I think that overall the design of the study and hopefully ultimately the legs it has afterwards are going to benefit from that. So I really want to thank the people that you see listed up here for their incredible guidance in organizing and running this trial here. As Dr. Khan mentioned, we have some outstanding collaborating organizations here that we've been working together now with for almost 15 years, actually. It's been, again, an incredible partnership of four great organizations. And I want to also specifically mention Dr. Clive Kieran and Dr. Sam Goldhaber, who can't be here today. They've been really visionary leaders in the thrombosis arena for a long time and provided very important guidance in the doing of the study. Clive in particular in the design of the study and the real-world implementation has been absolutely instrumental in all of our thinking throughout. David Cohen as well, really outstanding people that have been leaders in this for many years. As for our status today, again, 23 sites are active on protocol version 4.7, which we have, again, subsequently modified to improve over time and try to make the study more doable, in particular to address issues with the inflow of patients into the study and the workflow around that. We have 14 new sites in various stages of startup. Again, the data collection and the verification of data and site monitoring are active. We've visited 10 sites so far for monitoring visits, and that's going to continue as we go forward. We're actively supporting your efforts at the sites as best we can with a number of different tools, both online tools as well as printed materials. And of course, those, you're welcome to ask for more when you need them, and let us know and give us feedback on what we can do more to help you. And we're also making visits out to the sites to talk about on-site issues, and that's going to continue also during this year. Now, one very important thing we'll be talking about for much of the meeting, really, is the need to get people into the study. And I think I can just say bluntly that we are running way behind. We set out milestones with the NIH. These days, they really expect us to meet our milestones, and the study's continuation, its funding continuation, depends on whether or not we meet those milestones. And so it's absolutely urgently important for every site to put extra energy into really trying to learn the best they can how best to go about enrolling patients, to regularly review your practices, what you're doing, and to continue to keep on trying to improve them, keep on trying to reach out and attract more patients to your practices so that we can make this go forward. This is an urgent issue at this point, really. The NIH is all about finding opportunities to cut funds from projects that don't seem like they're proceeding. And even if our advocates have been very helpful to us in trying to push that forward, at the end of the day, this is a large government organization that has to identify opportunities where it can, and we don't want to be one of those opportunities for streamlining of government efficiency. So again, a big vision that we have for the study, it really demands a large commitment from all of you, and we know that, and we're so thankful that you're willing to be part of this. You know, you entered the study really as a nationally leading Venus Care team. That's why you were selected. That's how we reviewed your site applications. That's how we sort of looked at this. You, by being part of this network, you have access to a tremendous range of resources in terms of expertise in different areas of clinical care. Please try and utilize that. And really, CTRACT probably is one of the highest quality ongoing Venus Care initiatives. So I hope that we can all be proud of being part of it and determined to make it succeed. Remember that many times when we're seeing individual patients, our sense is that, well, my focus needs to be on the single person, and that's absolutely correct. We all feel that as physicians. Having said that, it's important to remember that being part of this trial and supporting it really is an opportunity to influence the care of many, many thousands of patients. You know, also motivate your trainees to reach for the stars and do things in, quote, the right way, and elevate the level of discourse among different specialists. I want to point out that, you know, we are very respectful and encouraging of any kind of organized research in the venous disease arena. Having said that, there are a number of single-arm studies that are looking at different kinds of stents and even other kinds of studies that are out there. And I want to just point out that, again, we are absolutely support these things being completed. On the other hand, CTRACT is a one-of-a-kind opportunity, really. It is more work with less resources. We absolutely appreciate that. And so the temptations to be involved in other things are totally understandable. But this is going to give you very rigorous data. There are very strong precautions against bias in the CTRACT trial. Again, we're not necessarily focused on a single device, but we're focused on a treatment paradigm overall. And I think a positive result will really result in many more patients that are offered the opportunity. A negative result will spare many patients from going down this road that can result in a permanent device being placed in their body without enough of a benefit in the long run. So really, this is about overall improving health outcomes rather than focus on one device. And should you come into opportunities to participate in other studies, I would just ask that you please give a lot of thought as to how you're going to make sure that the CTRACT trial really maintains a certain priority so that we can make sure that we get that done. The value of these kinds of trials goes beyond just looking at a specific treatment. We learn so much about the disease itself, post-thrombotic syndrome and DVT, the pathophysiology, the epidemiology. We learn a lot about measurement tools, of how we should be measuring the disease, and we identify gaps there. And then also, of course, the patient management. We want to really encourage the idea that the NIH should be putting more funds and more resources into these kinds of endovascular studies. We haven't had a whole lot of that over the years. We want to encourage that, and the way to encourage that best is to get the studies done in an effective way. Back in 2009, we had our first investigator meeting, and you know, I look at this, the upper left here is the thing that I put on my last slide of the investigator meeting there. I mean, so like ambitious, but verging on arrogant almost, you know, just utterly over the top. But having said that, I will say that the output of the ATTRACT trial, you know, the top six papers you see here are all papers, and I put the topics on the right. These are published articles from that study. And if you look at the range of types of information that have come out from the ATTRACT trial, and then also the papers at the bottom that are in progress now, they deal with the pathophysiology of the disease, the open vein hypothesis, who should we treat, how should we best measure the disease, and how should we use the measurement tools, subgroups, cost effectiveness, quality of life. The range of information about the disease that we collect from these high quality NIH trials, really it just nothing else really compares with it out there. And so I hope that you'll see the study as a great opportunity. I'll mention too that I'm so proud that in these six papers we've published so far, we've had 63 different co-authors, of whom most of them are from our site investigator network. And so we really view this as a partnership with all of you. I want to congratulate our top enrolling sites so far in the CTRACT trial. University of North Carolina, Bill Marson and Zach Gortler at Northwestern University, Kush Desai and Christy Kennedy, who will be sharing some of their insights in one of the panel sessions later on. At Temple University, Riaz Bashir and Jenny Wong. Gunderson, Izana Azin, Irina Shaknovich, and then Sarah Myers. And then the University of Iowa, Mel Sharafuddin, Maria Kanaya, Judith Pena Quivado. A number of co-investigators at these sites that have really played huge roles, really, in advancing the sites forward. So thank you and congratulations. Congrats also to my team in doing a great job at Washington University. I think that one very important lesson I hope that comes out of this meeting is that the vast majority of us are trained as MD physicians, and we're trained to be great doctors. A minority of us have also had some form of clinical research training that's focused mainly on methodology and design, probably. But almost no one gets trained in real-world clinical trial implementation. And in truth, in our national research enterprise, that is a huge challenge and a huge barrier. How do you manage a project locally and be successful in recruiting patients, doing a study in an ethical and regulatory appropriate way, and getting a result? We know that investigator-initiated NIH studies are particularly different because of the resourcing considerations, and because you're not really running it. CROs work in a different sort of way overall. And so it's very important for us to take stock and learn about our own trial. With the ATTRACT trial, the first couple of years were incredibly difficult. But we kept learning and we kept changing, and our site network kept evolving. And really, it was almost like a chameleon. By the time the enrollment period ended, we were doing things very differently than the way that we were doing them up front. We were talking about them differently than the way we did up front. So I hope that you'll see this as an opportunity to really try and learn some things about how to get studies done. It's up to us to make that intentional choice to really be active learners and kind of transform ourselves into an effective clinical trial network. What does that mean? I think most of all, it means being active and not passive. I think that we're busy as heck when we get out of here, right? Right now it's great, but when we go back to our day jobs, it's incredibly busy. And forcing us to take a little bit of time to meet with our study team on an every week or two basis, to just touch base about the study, to address challenges, and to just review what we've been doing and make changes and reach out further. It does take time, it does take effort. No easy way to couch that, but we really appreciate the efforts and hope that we can encourage you to take further steps. Again, we need to be willing to learn new research skills and learn how to talk about these treatments that we deliver in the context of a randomized assessment. On our side, we've tried to make the protocol easier to use in terms of some of the things, in terms of improving the inflow into the study. And MedUSA is kindly donating compression stockings, which hopefully adds to the value proposition to patients as well. We're very grateful to have the support of the community organizations that Dr. Khan mentioned earlier. The American Venous Forum has gone above and beyond and really making big announcements to its entire member network and engaging in a longitudinal, long-term partnership with us to get the word out there. I'm so grateful for that. The Society of Interventional Radiology Foundation has done a lot to get the word out in the IR community through different kinds of postings. I did a podcast for them recently. Society for Vascular Medicine has included information at their meetings and in their newsletter on the CTRAC trial. The American Vein and Lymphatic Society, we did an interview for Vein Magazine. They've done some print and online video for us, and they're thinking about ways to utilize their mailing list to get information out to their membership. The North American Thrombosis Forum, we've had the opportunity to talk about this trial and about post-thrombotic syndrome at their VTE support group, evening support groups online. And then they've also put articles in their newsletter, and they've provided us some guidance on social media as well. And then the National Blood Clot Alliance, also an organization that includes both patients and laypersons as well as providers, has really been very helpful to us in refining our social media strategy and in leveraging their own very robust social media network to get word about the trial out there. Again, thank you so much for your incredible commitment to helping us here. So the next phase here, I think that again, we need to work on recruitment. We're gonna continue to help share what we've learned and hopefully learn from you as well about how we get the value proposition of this out to providers and patients. We need to somehow connect up patients to your teams at your sites. We're going to continue to add sites, and then we're going to also transition a little bit to talking about patient retention as well in the study, because we know that that's equally important in terms of as enrollment, in terms of making sure that at the end you really get outcomes assessed in these patients that can be used in the final analysis. But ultimately, we're confident that we'll succeed. It's important to us to make it happen. The NIH has invested $12 million in a study of post-thrombotic syndrome. Just think about that. It doesn't come along every day, right? And so it's on us to make sure that we utilize those resources and that opportunity well. On the other hand, we've got great tools now. We now have direct-acting oral anticoagulants. We have intravascular ultrasound. We've got new FDA-approved venous-engineered stents. And so the tools that we use to treat these patients have improved substantially over the last decade or two. Lots of patients that really need our help, a great community out there, and I think that we've learned in some ways the hard way through doing a previous large trial that we're going to have to grow, but if we stay determined and we stay willing to do that, that we can get this sort of seemingly impossible task done as we have done before. So again, thank you so much for all your efforts so far, and I'm looking forward to a great meeting. I want to introduce